I really wish it was as easy as me standing up here and telling you what to do and you going and doing it, but it's, so I'm, what I'm trying to do it today is give you some insight into the process, give you some of what I, perspective that I've had. I've been doing this a long time, and in fact, I sort of think I was one of the first people at Purdue to actually go serious into the competitive grants world in the agronomy department. So it, there's been a guy before me who left right when I got there that has started doing that, but it was a new thing. So I sort of, this is kind of the world I've come up in terms of my existence. So why am I talking to you today? One, I'm a sucker. I get asked, and they say I was already here, so I said sure again. I gave this talk sort of last year. I've chaired four federal review panels, USDA. I've chaired mostly USDA panels. I was on a EPA panel. I've been on NSF, DOE, EPA. Done private panels. Those are kind of interesting. I've done state and university level research review panels, about 22 in total. So I've seen a lot of proposals. I mean, that's probably close to a couple thousand proposals. And so I've been writing grants. That's what I do, probably always will do. I've written probably, I think Freddie figured this out the other day, I've probably written about 100 proposals. And I can guarantee you they're not all been funded. Otherwise I would be probably retired. So I'm currently of support on a PI or co-PI on about $2 million right now of money. We're in the process of, we have applications out for about another, I'm involved in a large NSF effort. It's about $25 million proposals out right now. So it's an ongoing process. It's constantly happening. The most recent thing I got funded was a USDA SEEP project, which has been an interesting experience, which is a very large collaborative project. So here we go. You guys are in grad school, postdocs, early professors here? What do we got? Everything? How's that early professor job working out? Exciting? Not bad? Okay. Good. Glad to hear that. That's not usually the response I get, so that's good. I usually get moans. So you're going to become a faculty member somewhere, right? When you transition between a postdoc or a grad school, you become a faculty. It's a big transition. And you get expectations for reaching tenure, and this is really part of that process. Grants are part of that total process of becoming a faculty member. So you've got expectations in education in terms of undergrads and grads. You got extension. If you do extension work, you have time in the state expectations, and you got research proposals and papers as expectations. Oh yeah. And you got your actual life somewhere in there as an expectation. Don't put a lot of weight on that yet. When you get to be about 50, how old am I? 52, you can sort of start thinking about it. So the kids are gone, and you know, I had kids. No, it's not that bad. It's just fine. It can be on some days. So things you need to know right now, so you just know where you are. The state you're working in and the university you work for are not going to be providing you support, okay? That just isn't going to happen. If you think that it is, you better start talking to other people. State and university money is going away. They may give you a little bit to start with, and I'll talk about that in a while here, but continued state support is very difficult to find. Continued university support is very difficult to find anymore in terms of research. Hatch funding is currently at the federal level fighting for its life. You guys familiar with the Hatch funding? It's a part of the ag school programs. It's fighting for its very existence at the federal level. It's only a matter of time until something bad happens to that. So that's going to go away. So don't count on that too much. So the easy money's all gone. Sorry to tell you that. So you're back to writing proposals. Why do you need to write proposals? Here's why, right here in this one set of pictures. Equipment and people are why you got to write grants. Okay? You'll get a chunk of money again when you start up, and you can buy stuff for your lab, or you can do some things. 2 years, they've forgotten who you are in the startup office, and you're on your own. So anything you want to buy, anything you want to purchase is going to come off a grant. And if you're going to hire people, you're going to hire technical staff, you're going to hire postdocs, you're going to hire grad students, et cetera, you're going to pay for all that. Now, some schools have some programs for grad students, but the majority of what you're going to be doing is paying for equipment and paying for people. And that's basically, you're becoming a project manager more than a researcher as you move into a faculty position. You're going to be involved in some work in the lab, but you're mostly going to be involved with is trying to get support for the things you want to do that other people are going to do for you. People and equipment. So this requires now that you become part of this thing I call the research machine. which really has a, it's a five-part machine, okay? Let's see if this story works. This is new. So, it's got five parts to it. First part of it is the idea and the data part, okay, to support proposals. And this includes preliminary data. So this is a really important thing I'll come back to is preliminary data and how you can utilize it to your best advantage. Then you have the second part of the machine, proposals to support funding, okay? So proposals are a mechanism to achieve funding, okay? They don't guarantee a thing. You write a proposal, it does not guarantee a thing. What it guarantees is if you have just spent some number of hours writing that proposal, it doesn't guarantee you're going to get a dime. All it does is say you basically bought the ticket at that point when you wrote the proposal. Whether you get the right or not, it's a whole different story. So you get the funding, that supports your research, okay? The research leads to data and publications then, okay? And the publications publications then power discovery. And the discovery then feeds back into more proposals and more grant money. So proposals that lead to funding are now your lifeblood, as funding allows you to work, okay? That's really what I'm trying to portray in that set of things there. So you want to buy this ticket, if you want to buy the ticket, here's the ride you have to take, okay? It's a fairly straightforward process, this whole thing. It's just a matter of sort of committing yourself to making some changes in how you do things and how you sort of view some avenues of work. So proposals are part of your existence as a faculty member. They're part of your core of how you're going to pay for everything is through this proposal process. Now, again, some schools have support. Some schools provide this or that to you. Some schools will do deals with you. They'll pay half of this or half of that, that kind of thing. But in reality, anymore, it's a proposal process to a federal program really leads to big programs. So I'm going to provide you sort of three general keys for writing proposals. Oops, no, I'm not. I'm going to skip right by it. There we go. So the keys are motivations, why you want to write a proposal, and what's going on there. The process itself, which is relatively, once you do a couple, you'll get sort of familiar with the process. And it's almost, I don't even view it as a major obstacle anymore, the process. It's just sort of what you do. I mean, it's just part of the deal. And then some finer points I want to touch on, including a sort of a subtle new finer point that I've discovered of late that's really kind of important in terms of defining your name. This is an odd thing, but there's a lot of electronic evaluations of people going on now, and it's important that you sort of define how you want your name in the literature in terms of actually the physical structure of your name, first name, last name, and middle initial kind of thing. So it's really interesting. I'll explain that a little later. So what are the motivations for writing a proposal? Well, finding problems to work on is easy. People will give you problems when you step in the door in your new job. They'll say, oh, you need to work on this, you need to work on that. That's not gonna be a problem. It's much more difficult to define the problems that are important, okay? This is your job. Your job is to filter through all this noise you're gonna get from all your fellow faculty members who think you should be working on something that'll benefit them, okay? Now, that's not bad. It's just you need to sort of think about your long-term program early on once you get on the job. You need to think about where you want your program to go and sort of start to define the kind of problems you want to work on. It's an important problem that you should be working on. Working on important problems will get you funded, quite frankly. If you're working on an important problem and you present a motivated proposal, you will probably get funded for it. I'm not going to guarantee that, but you should be able to find funding for important problems. Okay, that's out there. Because the funding agencies look at the important problems when they define the proposal request areas. So it loops around on you. So if it's an important problem, for example, I'm a microbiologist, I work on pathogens, I work on E. coli, pathogenic E. coli, and I've worked on Salmonella and a couple other things. We did preliminary data on preliminary work on that. The federal agencies caught up with us, basically. They had a whole program on pathogens, and we got funded through that program. So it's not exactly synced up, but it's pretty close. So the scientific community helps the agencies define the problems, and so the scientific community tends to have looking at the most important problems. So if you're working on important problems, you can fit into that scenario pretty well of getting funded. So proposals and grants are not the end point. They are your means. I think that's really a difference. It's something you got to think about. Okay. When you get in, people sort of put an endpoint almost on the term proposals and grants. It's like, oh, I got a grant. Great. All that means is now you have to do work. Okay. So if you think about it, this is a backward system. You're writing something to get money to do work. If you didn't write the proposal, would you have to do the work? No. So man, it makes some decisions there. So they support your work and allow you to pay for students, postdocs, and other stuff, you know, the science stuff you get to buy. So I put proposal development on a process on par with writing a paper. Okay, it's an intellectual process, defining the problems, defining the literature. It's that important. I think you should put that much energy into it in terms of writing a proposal. It's not something to slam together 3 days before it's due. You should really think about it in terms of an intellectual undertaking. You are trying to convince 23 people in a room somewhere in Washington, D.C. that your ideas are the best ideas out of the 140 proposals they look at. Okay? That's your goal. You're selling your program, yourself, your ideas to this agency and these reviewers. And the reviewers are you. Okay? That's the other thing here. The reviewers aren't some mysterious force in the universe. They're other scientists. And they take on this interesting dynamic in this room when they're reviewing proposals. They are protecting the federal money. It's an interesting switch. They come into the room, they come in as scientists, oh, we're here, we're going to help out the best science. Then all of a sudden it's their money and they're protecting it. We're going to keep you from wasting USDA money. It's what this last panel I was on, I sort of felt that way. And the question, you can tell that when the question comes up, do we have to fund, we have to use all this money? To imply the proposals, we didn't have enough good proposals. That was early on in the process, but it didn't work out that way. But then, so it's really important that you think about the importance of your problem and you present it in a really convincing manner. And this is really what you're about here, this whole process. It's just an intellectual process. It's really important that you spend the energy, the mental energy on this thing to make this work, okay? You'll write a better proposal if you have good ideas and make them real. So what are you passionate about, okay? It's important. What do you know about? What is the problem? Why is it important? That all goes into the proposal. You just can't get up there and in your proposal and assume anything about what's going on in there that everyone will know about. You have to be convincing. You have to provide the reviewer the motivations you feel towards that project area. So how is the existing knowledge or practice inadequate? So a lot of proposals are about fixing something that was done wrong before. So why is that? Why is your idea better? Okay. Why is your idea new or unique or different? That's just all going to go into the proposal. What are you going to contribute? Okay. What's your piece of work going to change or contribute to the world of science? And then what's the impact of that, both scientifically and practically, of your work? This is all the kind of things you need to think about in terms of motivations for writing a proposal. So, yeah, sort of two levels of motivation. You have overarching fundamental questions you want to answer. Why is the sky blue? Okay. That would be a really bad question to send to NSF, I can just tell you. But if you wanted to send to NSF what the impact of global change is on sky color, that might be different. So, it's the same question, right? It's just a different phrasing and making it more important. So, you're solving a real problem. In agriculture, we tend towards a lot of these real problem questions. In terms of the panels I've been on, why do you see pathogens near swine lagoon kind of situations, or those kind of practical questions? Is runoff going to be treatable? That kind of thing. And the other invitation for motivations is in terms of transferring knowledge. So then you get the other column here, promotion. Oh, now we get some personal motivation. It's going to come up when you go up, your package goes up for promotion, whether you have grant money or not. I can guarantee it. Okay? It's going to be on there for two reasons. One, it's just the process of getting the grant money is part of this game now. And then two, if you don't have grant money, the likelihood you'll have enough publications to be promoted isn't too great. So it's a feedback loop you get into. Grants do offer some prestige to you in terms of people say, oh, you got grant money. Hey, you're okay. And then the next sentence will be, how many papers you published out of that money yet? That's the next sentence. So it never stops, okay? This never stops. So you get students, you get publications, you get admirations, you get more grants, you get to feed the machine again, because you get more ideas from your grants you just got funded, you do some work, and you say, oh, we didn't really anticipate this happening. We need to write another proposal to find out what this other thing is that's going on. So this becomes, I look at this, as part of the research portfolio, your professional portfolio, research, teaching, and outreach. You do an outreach, and then life is in there somewhere. The RFP, the request for proposals there, that's part of your package. You're going to write grants as part of your research package. And I really want to emphasize here that I personally have a significant amount of grant money in the outreach area, okay? Outreach and teaching are, I think, underutilized in agriculture in terms of grant applications. There is a lot of money that goes by our faculty in those two areas. There's a lot of, and the proposals are a little different than research proposals, but there's some pretty interesting things you can do under a teaching or under an outreach umbrella in terms of grant applications. That they can be coupled to things, they can be the delivery mechanism for things. It's really, I think, it really needs to be looked at more by a lot of people. So, this is part of this motivation process. So you're assembling this sort of research portfolio. You're sitting there in your plush new office with your brand new chair, get that new desk someone paid for, you know, you get that nice new computer. You're sitting there and you're going, you come in. We don't charge much for being late, okay. Few people can really predict their sort of life tree out very far, but try to envision where you want to be in about 5 years again. Okay, this is really important because what I've seen happen to assistant professors is they get caught in this I want to do everything deal. Everyone's pulling them different directions. They want to go work on this project and that project and this project and that project. And they never really assemble their own pathway very well. And the ones I know that are very successful have done that. They have sort of try to envision where they want to be out a few years and then work towards that. They do some other things, but they want to really look out for themselves a bit in that process. So you have to sort of go between different things. You have gradients. You have disciplinary and interdisciplinary projects. Your stuff versus your stuff in other projects. Okay. Short-term versus long-term projects. You want to do something for a quick publication. You want to do long-term research out there. So you have basic and applied studies you can do. Some things publish a little easier or quicker. And you know, individual versus team efforts. There's a lot of energy put in the team projects. I've done a lot of them. I'm involved in a couple of really big ones. And quite frankly, I don't think team projects are for the faint of heart, quite frankly. I think they're very difficult to do well. And they do require a certain level of energy that needs to be, you need to be carefully rationing your time in terms of introduction of yourself early on in your career in the team projects. You got to think about it and sort of hold out some portion of your time for that, but don't put all your time into that. You need to really get yourself there, and you need to be working on your own area a bit as well. So the other thing you'll discover right away is that there is a sort of funding cycle that exists, all right? NRI, the funding cycles are coming up right now. Stuff's starting to be due in November, December, and January, okay? All the NRI calls. So you need to know all that. You need to know where they are in that cycle, and USDA is pretty good about keeping the pattern the same. So that way you can plan the rest of your life around the funding cycle. Isn't that a great story to tell? What are you doing? Well, I'm getting ready for the big submission dates. I mean, oh, great. That's basically it. NSF tends to be a little less regular, and when their stuff's due, and some of the big stuff, their smaller programs are pretty well sort of in a month time frame. So you need to know when all those are. And you should sort of put those in your life's plan for that year in terms of when things are coming up. So, here we go. Success on a grant proposal equals preparation plus the opportunity. So you always should be thinking one step ahead for proposal submissions. If NRI is going to have a soils and soil biology program, and they do, this is what I'm familiar with, basically they're going to ask the same set of questions every year for submission, right? It'll be some nuance in there that'll be a little different. If you're thinking about submitting to an NRI program that's due in December, you should be thinking about submitting sometime in August. So you're starting your preparation. Or maybe even before that. You're starting to assemble some type of a plan for that opportunity. So you're thinking one step ahead. You're not waiting to the last minute to submit something. You can get away with that later. I mean, I'll be honest. You can get away with it later once you have a pretty established set of preliminary data or stuff you can pull from and say, you know, our previous work shows this, da-da-da-da. Then you can push it a little bit in terms of the due dates. But you really, early on, you ought to be thinking a little bit ahead in case you need to generate some preliminary data. So the preparation part is never stop learning. Thinking is an important activity. Okay, this is where I fail recently a lot is spending enough time sort of thinking about where the real problems are, doing enough background, doing enough intellectual process on these ideas to make them sellable as a proposal. So you need to be reading and you need to be reviewing and using the World Wide Web for stuff. Get that going in terms of opportunities, but. And preparation. So success is the preparation plus the opportunity. The preparation is up to you. The opportunity will come from the feds at some point in terms of a program area. Success is the ability to go from failure to failure without losing your enthusiasm. I like that. So you're going to submit, you're going to fail, but you're going to submit again, right? You're going to enthusiastically submit again. I'm going to get it this time. Okay. Where do you get your ideas from? Who's got an idea for a proposal? Anybody here? Yeah, what do you got?
I would like to use the reclaimed soil for biofuel production.
Use what?
Reclaimed soil
for biofuel production. That proposal has already been submitted about 9 times.
Yeah, but these are not the manure impacted soil, which I'm thinking I did not anywhere under the last 5 years.
Okay, and you researched that?
Yes.
Okay, see, he's prepared, preparation. And you're gonna say that in the proposal, aren't you? Okay, so that's what you need. That's a good solid idea. He's done some background on it. That's a good, anybody else got an idea for a proposal? I'm writing these down because I'm short right now. Yeah.
How to incorporate biological char produced by professional agriculture
into no-till agriculture. As a remediation kind of thing? Or
as a fertilizer.
Fertilizer, okay. And where are you going to apply for that to? Who are you going to apply to? That's a real hard one to apply for. So the biofuel angle is good, okay, as a byproduct to biofuel production.
Looking at USDA and the other NSF.
Yeah, I wouldn't, well, just sort of sidebar, I wouldn't go to NSF for that, but USDA or DOE. So, but that's the kind of thing you need to be thinking about. You've got ideas, you need to be doing the literature on it, see what's out there. Because I can tell you, sit on a review panel, and there's always somebody on there, that panel, who knows that area pretty well, and will tell the rest of the reviewers for you that your idea is not new. Okay? It's a great process. That's what this review panel thing really is interesting, is that you get on the panel, you're sitting there, and you've reviewed the proposal, and somebody else reviews the proposal, another person reviews the proposal, and one of those people is usually a pretty solid expert in that area, and they'll know all the literature back till 1901. And, well, in 37, there was a paper published that said, you know, whatever, and so you need to make sure you cover all that, and you're really a thorough about ideas that you're trying to advance something with, that you've covered all the background stuff. So the ideas are good. I mean, biofuels is a hot area, so that's, I think USDA needs to put a little more money into it. That's a different story. Opportunities multiply as they're seized. Okay, so you got an idea, and you take that idea and you start working on it. You'll find other ideas out of that as you move through that process of writing that proposal. Other things will come to your mind at that point as you're moving through it. But ideas are also like rabbits. You get a couple, learn how to handle them, and pretty soon you have a dozen. Okay, ideas are important. You talk to your colleagues in your department about your ideas. They will help you make those ideas bigger and better. Okay? They will help you see other opportunities there. What are the environmental impacts of putting char in? Is there a soil processes you're affecting? Is there do you shift microbial communities? Do you you know, all that kind of stuff? Is there a water quality component to that? So that's all kinds of things. So except in politics and infomercials, I love infomercials. They're just the greatest. 3 a.m. You can learn all kinds of important things. You can change your entire body overnight. It's amazing for a couple bucks. A bad idea is a bad idea no matter how well it's presented, okay? So you really need to flesh out your idea and your proposal. Make sure it's not a bad idea. It's something inherently wrong with it that somebody's going to catch. I was involved recently with a proposal on campus where I saw it after it got submitted. The hypothesis was fundamentally flawed. It had a fundamental error in the hypothesis. And if anybody in the area sees it, they'll know it in a second, and the proposal's dead. So this person wrote this proposal, their hypothesis had a fundamental flaw in it that they hadn't bothered to check on or hadn't talked to anybody about. The panel sees it, somebody on the panel will catch it, I know. It's a pretty fundamental issue. So if the idea is kind of bad, the proposal was nicely done otherwise, but that hypothesis statement is going to slaughter them on review. So you need to be careful on that kind of thing. Good ideas presented badly will not be funded. Okay? You can have the best idea on the face of the earth and have a crappy looking proposal with crappy formatting and crappy everything going on in it. You're not going to get funded. Okay? Details count. People, reviewers, this is my favorite. Last year I was on this panel and somebody had left their track changes on when they submitted their proposal. Made reviewing real easy. Because one of the big comments on the side of this is, I'm telling no lie on this, the track change comment said, I don't know how we're going to do this. Panel picked up right on that one. There was not even an issue there. That one went over to the DNF pile right away. For two reasons. One, we didn't know how they were going to do it either, and they left the track changes on. Two bad things. So details do count. But really, the idea is where you want to put your energy for your proposal. What is your idea? How do you flesh it out? How do you backstop it with literature? How do you backstop your idea with preliminary data? Okay? It's the make or break point for the proposal. And note, after four submissions to some idea and you don't get funded, your idea is probably not a very good one. One submission's okay, you know, because you probably put it in. I like to give you my story on this. We work with Mycobacterium, and we're looking at it in soil. We submitted a proposal last year, no preliminary data in it at all. We just had this great idea, and they came back and said, you need preliminary data. So we're going to go back this year with preliminary data because we generated a bunch of it. We'll see how that goes. But the idea was okay. The lack of detail in preliminary data, whether we could do this or not, was missing in the proposal. So if you don't get, I'll talk about review later, but if you get after four submissions and you don't get funding, you maybe have a bad idea. So which is first, the idea of the RFP? RFP being a request for proposal. Have you guys all seen RFPs? Everybody seen one? They're on the web. The web's wonderful. It used to be you had to call and get one shipped to you and all this other stuff, but now you can just download them every day if you want. There's a new RFP coming out. So what comes first? Is it the RFP or the idea? I think it should be the idea. But with in mind, the RFP is coming, okay? Do not wait on your idea. Start thinking about it. Start writing out your ideas. Start thinking about how you're going to do this. Start sort of outlining the whole concept in your mind, or at least putting it on paper, talking to people. Gather information. Get some input, attend some meetings. This is a good meeting for ideas. You know, I picked up one this morning at a session I was at. It was like, hey, this is pretty cool. I'm going to try this new method. This is pretty slick. Read and review. If you are asked to review proposals, you should do that. Okay, if you're asked to be on a panel, you should do that. Okay, even if it's a big pain in the butt, but you make $400 for a week, it's great. Plus per diem. And you can stay usually in a pretty nice hotel. They're not too bad on the hotels anymore. So talk to others about your ideas. Serve on review panels. I do that all the time. I mean, I'm kind of a sucker for it. I know the people pretty well in D.C. I like the review panels. It's a very intellectual process. I mean, it's very fun to be there. All these new ideas going on, all this new stuff going on, and a lot of bad stuff going on, too, in terms of proposals. I'll tell you a little secret. Review panels love bad proposals. It's really easy, because you can just make a decision really quick. So don't help them there if you can avoid it, okay? Don't help. You need to also get out of your comfort zone a little on where you're getting your ideas from. And I think this is really the spark of this in terms of what's going on. I'll explain that a little better in a second. So, here's the idea circle. Did I go the right way? Sorry. Okay. You probably won't find an exact match for your idea. Someone's not going to say, you live in Iowa. For Iowa soils, what's the effect of biofuel production? Probably not going to, well, maybe the Iowa Corn Bureau will do that. So you're going to have to be flexible a bit on your ideas. So you get your ideas, you're working them up, write them down. I suggest you write them down. So you'd be prepared to make adjustments as the RFP come out, okay? So you're making adjustments, you're thinking about it, you get the stuff going on in your mind about what's going on, so it's there. So the real key on this is to get your idea, you should do some preliminary experiments, okay? This is the killer on proposals. This is the biggest thing I see on review panels. No preliminary data. And we're very happy to point that out to you, okay, as a reviewer panel, review panel. This is a great idea. Is it feasible? And it's the feasibility you're providing with the preliminary data. I can do this, is what you're saying. I have some other words I use, but I won't use them here. We can do this project. We can do this work. We can extract DNA from soil. I mean, it's and it doesn't really always matter if the preliminary data says a whole lot. The fact that you did it on the project and you sort of were working that way, it's important. I'll show you an example of how big it can be in a second. So preliminary data will empower your ideas. And this is something I really emphasize to people starting out. You guys will get, you know, these fancy high-powered professor jobs, assistant professor jobs now, big salaries, cars, access to the company yacht. It's a different school. You're going to get some money at startup, right? Maybe. Maybe some cash, right? Maybe a grad student thrown in, $100,000. Purdue's average startup package is $400,000, something like that. I don't know. That's true, actually. It's a big number. The single most important component of any proposal is preliminary data. Okay? You can do this project, is what preliminary data says. And if you have startup money, you should put aside a chunk of that to develop preliminary data on your ideas. That's the most important thing I can tell you all day, right there, is that preliminary data is really a driver for successful proposals. Because you're going to submit your proposal. Here you are, a nice young assistant professor. You probably have a couple publications or something from your grad school. And even a postdoc, you got a few publications. Now you're on your own, you're submitting this proposal in. And you're starting this new lab up. And the review panel will go, oh, this is nice. Can they actually do this? There's no preliminary data. You're in the DNF file. Do not fund. Yeah. You work it in. You can do it two ways. You can put it in the literature review part. You can sort of read through. You can sort of put, I don't know why I'm telling you this, but you can put it, and I need more competitors. You can put it in the literature review is where I usually use it a lot, where you have a background information, and you can say, our recent work shows that. And then, or you can put it in the materials and methods if it's got a methods component to it. So you want to show you're going to do something. We have done this with the following instruments to show that, those kind of things. It's important to work it in there. It's really good to put it in the literature review as sort of ongoing, or in the materials and methods as a proof that you can do the procedure. And you can then say something like, expanding on our background work on this in the actual procedure part of the proposal. You can put it in there too. It's a little more awkward there. So in the introduction material or in the method is a really good place to put it. It just shows that you can do it, and then refer back to it. A nice figure is the easiest thing to get in there. Some kind of figure to show some response that you're trying to build up in the rest of the proposal. It's a really nice addition in terms of information. Don't spend a lot of time analyzing it for them either. That's the other thing. Just present it and sort of state briefly how it fits the proposal. So ideas in the proposal, this is sort of the kind of thing that the review panel looks for, okay? Novel, innovative is best, okay? But you know, you're not gonna hit a home run every time, so you're gonna be sort of flitting around the edges a little in terms of novel. I mean, how many novel E. coli studies in soil can there be, okay? There's not that many novel E. coli studies in soil, but they're still gonna be funding E. coli studies in soil. So you need to have an idea that's grounded in the literature, and you need to have the preliminary data part of that, and get it fortified that you can work your way into that. And you can also use data from your existing publications, your thesis. You can use data from, if you permit, we'll have a deal you work out with your professor at your postdoc place. You're on a postdoc. You can put all that into the proposal, sort of as backgroundy stuff in terms of what's going on. It's best if you have some publications, and then you can launch out from there and say, in our initial work we did this, and then this is what happened, etc. So,
So you have this idea in the proposal, you have preliminary data for startup, right? Again, I know, I've talked to deans about this, that they could go out of their way to get you money for startup, and they don't like to see it wasted. So they want to see you use it for things like preliminary data. That's an important thing they want you to use it for. You need to show feasibility. Again, preliminary data does that, or you can show it with your CV. If you guys have published in some area and you're working on that in the proposal, it's good to show that. Cite yourself in the proposal. Don't be bashful about that. You know, some statement about this area, and then you cite yourself. That's an excellent thing to do. It shows that you can do this kind of work. I mean, it's important. Don't be bashful. This is no time to be modest. Okay, this is a massive sales job at a scientific level. If you're trying to prove you can do something, prove it, basically. So the other thing is that you get some people in trouble occasionally. It's not a big deal, but is the facility section of a proposal in terms of feasibility. If you're saying you're going to use flux towers to measure CO2 emissions from soil, and you don't have a flux tower, and you haven't proposed one, and you haven't paid for one in the proposal, some reviewer will find that and inform you of that a bit of information in the rejection letter. So you need to make sure you have what you need, or you're going to buy it in the proposal, or you're going to get it from somewhere. So that goes in the feasibility, the facility section. I'll tell you another secret there on facilities. You can write up a facility section you can use in lots of proposals. Write up a good one about your lab. It goes into some detail and keep it and use it for different proposals. It's not going to change that much through time. But you need to have it. Spend some time on the first or second proposals doing it. Make sure you got a good section written up about what your lab is capable of doing, and then what your department is capable of doing. And then if there's anything special at your university you want to highlight, put that in there as well. And then your idea may be great, and the proposal RFP may be here, and it sort of looks like they match, but make sure it's within the scope of the RFP. Okay, your idea may be a great idea independent of the RFP, but if you send it to the wrong agency, you're going to end up rejected sometimes based on that. And that's actually a rejection statement. Not within the scope of the RFP. So let me give you my personal example on this little world of weirdness. So I read all kinds of weird stuff, and I read Wired magazine, and I get CNE News because I'm a blog at ACS. And there's a big article in CNE News written by Vicki Colvin, who just got named to National Academy of Science, who said the environmental implications of nanomaterials have been overlooked. Okay. And she has a center down at Rice University. It's called Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology. And in the fall of 2003, I attended this thing called Nano Days, which is an outreach program they host. I flew down there. This is in Houston. And went to this thing. I didn't know much about nanomaterials. I didn't know much about Rice. I didn't know much about any of this. I knew from the CNE News, and I knew from the article in Wired magazine, this was going to be a big deal at some point. So I came back to Purdue, I put together this group, we talked about all these ideas, we did this sort of paper sharing about what was out there. We started a couple of experiments. In other words, we went out, we bought nanomaterials off the market and did initial soil studies with these nanomaterials, fullerenes particularly. We developed a literature review on this stuff and we waited. Okay. Lo and behold, same time, NSF and EPA announced calls on nanomaterials in the environment. We submit to both. We got a combined funding of about $2 million for those two agencies on nanomaterials in the environment. So that's sort of how I mean all this stuff put together in sort of a practical sense. An idea, sort of an overlooked idea you pick up from sort of doing future, it's called futuring, the jazzy term for it, looking down the road in terms of where the problems are going to be. Then looking for some place to send it, knowing it's probably going to be on everybody else's radar at some point, which is big time now. And then we checking my spelling. So we just waited and then submitted and got funded. It's unusual to get funded on the first submission, which we were pretty happy about. So here's an idea. Where do you get your opportunities from? Sorry, finding opportunities. Opportunities are missed by most people because it's dressed up and overall it looks like work. I thought that was kind of cute. Thomas Edison said that. So opportunities are important. Sometimes they look like they're going to be a lot of work. So where's your money coming from? Okay. Where are your opportunities going to be? You're going to be the federal government. All right? That's just gets cut right down to the core here. The big opportunities with the feds. Now, some states have pretty good programs. The other area I see as being a pretty good area in the environment is in this, it's called the 319 program, which is non-point source pollution related to 406 program. Again, federal issues. It's just disguised federal money. It's all over the place. There's all kinds of federal funding out there and availability. There's many agencies. There's hundreds of funding off programs. It's difficult to take to sort of understand that all that. So let me give you an example here. The feds now are trying to make it easy for us. Okay, you guys all know about grants.gov. You need to learn about grants.gov. I'm sorry, it's just the way it's going to be. The feds have put everything through this one site. It's called grants.gov. And there are 27 agencies that run through grants.gov, more or less. NSF is a bit of an outlier still. USDA, NRI's grants.gov, EPA STAR, DOD, DOE, USGS, DOE Education, all provide some kind of support and all kind of run through grants.gov. So I looked it up last week. For 2007-ish, federal programs provided something like $360 billion in grant funding. Okay, that's all programs. We don't apply; we can't apply for all that money. Okay, that's like for building bridges and a bunch of other stuff too. That's the kind of money the feds are kicking out for grants programs. So, the spring of 2007, grants.gov indicated there's approximately 1,000 open grants calls. Okay, of some sort or another. Not all again basic research, but just. Just things that the government needs. The thing that I thought was interesting, I don't do this kind of work, but I do watch the nano stuff, is that NASA's interested in building a space elevator. You guys know about space elevators? They're going to run a cable, a nano wire cable, up into space, and they'll be able to lift up things instead of shooting them on rockets. They'll lift them up. I'm perfectly serious on this. You guys are looking at me like I'm nuts. They are spending a lot of money on that area, and it's got the fallout from it is that they want to build stronger nanomaterials, and that's what they really are. The core of it is that. But there's a lot of money tied up in that. None of us can probably apply for it. But so it's those are the kind of things you learn on grants.gov. You should look at it. You should get registered. You should learn how to use it. You're gonna be stuck with this for the rest of your career in some version or another. We all complained when Fastlane came up to be used. We love Fastlane compared to grants.gov, but this is where it's all going. So on October 16th of this year, as of this year, there have been 300,000 submissions to grants.gov total since its inception. 300,000 people hoping for a miracle. So NSF has about $5.6 billion available. That's real money. That's money you can apply for. Basic science. This is from 2006, so there's 42,000 applicants to NSF, 42,376. 10,000 or so were funded, 25% success rate. Average funding, this isn't sort of surprising to some people, is $98,000. Okay? That's NSF. USDA NRI programs, which there's some people here talking tomorrow about those, you guys should probably go talk to them as well. It's about $180 million. That's an order of magnitude or two off there. Where the big bucks are in NSF and NIH, okay? Not USDA, I got bad news. USDA is the poor stepchild in the grants world. About 2,300 applications, about 20% funded, 433 projects funded. 10% of those funds went to F-score states, which I don't want to describe, but that's a different categorization they use. 1% went to new investigators, okay? And the way you get to be a new investigator is to check the box that says new investigator. Okay, they've relaxed the rules on proposals. You can be a new investigator and you can have existing PIs on the project with you now. It used to be you could only be a new investigator if you were by yourself. They changed the rules around. And what happens on new investigator awards, you don't necessarily want to be funded as a new investigator because you tend to get less money and it's sort of at the end of the process. You want to be funded as a regular investigator with a regular budget and just be a new investigator. You don't want to go to the new investigator category. The new investigator category is sort of used as kind of a consolation prize a bit in terms of this is a really good idea. We're not going to fund them at their full rate. We'll give them some money to develop their idea. That's usually how it gets used on these panels. It's okay. You're going to get money, but it's not the money you asked for. I have had state money over the years. Indiana is not particularly flush with cash for research. The things I can tell you about people I've talked with on state money is that it's basically a bit different than going to a national program. It's usually a problem-oriented situation. They have some problem they want fixed, want to understand. So you need to develop a relationship with the staff and work that way. It's not going to be a call. They're not going to necessarily going to put out a call and say, we're interested in whatever. And if they ask you to be on one of their review panels, which some states have review panels. I was on a couple for Indiana ones a long time ago. Work with them on that. It's a big pain. You have to go sit and do reviews, but you'll learn a lot about the state. Industrial money is highly individualized, okay? They're not going to have a call for industrial. DuPont's not going to send out a call for the environmental effects of auto polishes. Okay, they're not going to happen. But if you meet somebody from DuPont, you can talk to them about that kind of thing. They may be interested in funding something you're doing. So they tend to be on a pretty tight time schedule, and it's usually a problem situation. And there's and I can talk to you more. I've had some industrial money, and it's usually related to some kind of problem they're trying to solve quickly for some other kind of reason. So they're not real interested in basic science. They're more interested in a practical solution to a problem. So this is I had this in university and college sources. It's usually a small amount of money available on your campus. Get it, okay? That should be your primary objective. Day one is to figure out if your ag school or your research office has some kind of internal grants competition. If they do, you should get it. You should apply to it, okay? I tell you why, because when you get reviewed for tenure, people in that in your department will have had that money, and they'll be looking at your package to see if you got it too, okay? So if the internal money is available, you should get some of it in some way. Work on getting some of it. Because what you can do with that internal money is you can use it to generate preliminary data for bigger federal money. Okay, it's really, you can't build a research program around it, though I know people who have tried, but you can get your program going with it. And this is on top of whatever they give you when you start. The goal of all this stuff is always, and they'll tell you this, is to help you get federal dollars. So get the whatever you got on campus, university, your college, get that money. I don't care. Find out when it is. It's not going to be as easy to find out information on it. Talk to your department head. Talk to your program office, your sponsor program office. Figure out what's there, what's available, and play that game right away. Usually there's some kind of program for assistant professors. It seems to be a national thing. I can tell you about foundations, but at your stage in your careers, I sort of view them as kind of a waste of time, quite frankly. I have a real hard time with foundations now, and they're a particularly odd beast to deal with, okay? So if you're going to work with a foundation, you generally have to work with a university office to work with a foundation. Foundations don't typically have open solicitations. They do, but they're lying to you. You need to work with the foundation people. You need to go through a whole lot of steps involved, and they have specific things that they want, and they're different than the Fed. They may allow letters of inquiry, but if you want to do foundations, talk to your university people about it and how to get the best arrangement on it. Okay. The one difference in all this is that the big elephant in the room now is the Gates Foundation. We've just had a Gates Foundation project funded at Purdue. It's huge money. It's a whole different game. Okay, it's a whole different Gates, as you might expect. The Gates folks do things completely different, and they're not so obliging to following all the existing kind of paradigm in terms of how foundations work. So there's an opportunity. I think there's a major opportunity, especially in agriculture and nutrition and third world situations, maybe in the environment, with the Gates people. You need to work with your foundation people again on that, but there's some real opportunity there. So foundations are there in terms of a target, but they are they're difficult not because they're harder, but because it's a different process than you're setting up for with the government. So you're looking at all these agencies. Let's say you're looking at these agencies. You should know what USDA is interested in doing. Okay, You should know what the Soils Program, if you want, or the Plant Genome Project, or the Insect Project, or whatever you want to, you should sort of have an idea on that. So you should have the particular, you should read what they write in their calls, okay? So that's important. The other thing I get, and I got signed up for early on, before email was even really email, was some kind of alert service. And you guys can go through the Web of Science, Community of Science, you can go through grants.gov, and you can sign up for these alert services, okay? Do that. Do it tonight. You're in your hotel room with the my room, the internet comes and goes. You should sign up for something, okay? This is how you're going to get your information. Do not rely on your department head to send you announcements of when the next RFP is due, because you're going to have about a week to submit something then. The feds are obligated to send it out about 3 months ahead. I think it's 90 days now. So there should be an announcement out at least 90 days ahead of a call coming out, finalizing. So get on, Community Science, sign up. Your school belongs to that. You can go to Federal Grants and Contracts Weekly and sign up. I don't recommend that too much, but you get things like a new roof for a building in Oklahoma. We want a contract bid on that. Probably not going to be interested in that. Grants.gov, you can check off the boxes you're interested in receiving calls on. They're very good. You get stuff all the time. It's real simple. And then for the internal stuff on your campus, you're going to get some kind of announcement coming through the mail. Take a look at that and apply. Again, I think going after low apples is something you should really excel at in terms of dollars. If you've got money on campus, it's there, it's available. Scholarships, fellowship dollars, any of that kind of stuff you can send a two-page proposal in for, do it. Because it's going to help your program in terms of getting people and getting stuff going. Okay, writing a proposal. This is a lot harder than it appears, at least for the first 30 or 40 of them. I got this. This is great. These are just some grant things I've gotten emails on, I've collected. Free federal grants. Okay? I'm sending something into that. Free federal grants. Warning, if you're not joining the government grants program online, you read the reviews. Federal grants online. This is all crap, okay? This is all hokey stuff. But it's not this easy. It's much more difficult. Okay, so you've got this situation with the Fed now. You want to submit a proposal. They send you, I didn't bring it this time, but they send you a nice package and you download this PDF file, 261 pages long. It sucks up all your printer ink, but you've got it there on your desk. What are you going to do with it? You're going to read it, okay? Read the guidelines. The guidelines are very explicit, and you'll get rejected for not following the guidelines, okay? Or not following the call. Read the guidelines. The woman I do this talk with, Leslie Oliver, she does a lot of this interfacing for faculty with the feds, and she is constantly amazed at how many faculty don't actually read the guidelines and they want to submit to a program. You got to read the guidelines. Make sure you fit. So make sure you actually fit within the priorities. If the federal government, I was on this panel last year, if the federal government says they want to work on Salmonella, E. coli, and Shigella in the environmental exposure situation, and you submit a Klebsiella proposal, you're not going to get funded. It said E. coli, Salmonella, and Shigella. You submit Klebsiella. It's not going to get funded. You're outside of the guidelines. No matter how well you write that proposal, it's outside of the guidelines. So if you can't get within the guidelines, move on, modify it, or something. Make sure you get to the where you can fit into that thing. The other key here on this slide is that you really need to write this proposal for the reviewer. Okay. That's something that takes a while to figure out, but you're writing for the reviewers, you're not writing for yourself, unless you can sort of view yourself as a reviewer, which is hard to do eventually, but so you need to assume an uninformed but intelligent reader for about 80% of the review panel. But they'll ask questions, don't worry, there are going to be some pretty significant questions out of that sector, but so you're writing for the reviewers. Pre-planning is the key, okay? So, you guys all seen a successful grant proposal? Everybody should see one before they submit. You should get one from a colleague. Talk to your department head, talk to your grants office. Our grants office has a whole file of them that you can the people have turned over to them to let them look at. Go get them, look at them, okay? It's important to see what they look like. You can go online and you can get abstracts from every federal program, and everything that's been funded for the last bazillion years now, okay? So if you've got an idea on a project, you should go to that agency and look to make sure they just didn't fund something like it last year. And if they did, now you're gonna need to modify a bit to pick up that difference. And the other thing you should do, which is kind of painful occasionally, is bounce ideas off colleagues and say, hey, this is my idea. And then they'll go, thinking about that very long? And you'll go, yeah, well, I didn't think that. But your friends can be pretty critical, which is good. So you should ask for help and use the help, okay? So the process, first step, this is pretty much for any proposal you write, except maybe foundations, which are a little weird. What do you plan to do? There's going to be objectives. What do you want to do? The rationale. How are you going to do it? The experimental design. What are you going to do in each step? So the priorities and timeline. What are the outcomes? This is a major failure point in proposals, is what are the outcomes? How are you going to do analysis and interpretation? Huge failure point on proposals. We're going to collect data. Okay, what are you going to do with it? How are you going to analyze it? What statistical procedure are you going to use? You're going to use ANOVA. You're going to use this or that. How are they going to meet back to, how are you going to test the hypothesis or the objectives of your proposal with your analysis? That's the step they're looking for. That's the loop they want to close in proposals. And then, this is always an interesting part of the proposal, pitfalls. Where do you anticipate trouble and what do you do about it? And then most PIs, young PIs, think, oh, I don't want to tell them there's going to be any problems because they won't fund it. The panel has been doing research. They know there's going to be problems. It's not like you can hide that fact. Unless you're some kind of new breed of super researcher who never has any problems. But I always now put something in there about where I see the problems are going to occur, but I also provide an alternative. So if this happens, we'll do this, okay? If this doesn't work, we'll go to this approach. You don't have to be huge. You don't have to spend a huge amount of time on this. Just sort of anything that's kind of high risky in the proposal, you should have some kind of alternative plan for. So this is the sort of the first steps here. Now, I really, Leslie, again, the woman I work with on this stuff, really recommend this. Call the program office, okay? But don't call uninformed. Don't call up and say, I want to do this. Because you're going to call and they're going to... Sort of get your ideas together, okay? And write up an abstract of what you think your proposal will look like, okay? Then figure out who the program manager is. It's always listed. It's always in the call. There's some one person who's in charge of it. Be careful you don't get the person who's in charge of the submission versus the program person. Not the program person. The submission person doesn't really know about what's going on in the program. So get a time set up. Be polite. Be nice. Don't demand anything. Just say, I want to talk to you about this. And call on time. Discuss your ideas. But have your ideas formulated before you call. And you'll be surprised what they'll tell you and won't tell you about your stuff, okay? Their job is actually to make you successful. They're not there to block you at all. They're there to help a lot on things. So you're listening for sort of subtle responses. You sort of say, I want to do this. And they say, maybe that's a signal there. Okay, so you wanna, and they say something like, we've been looking for a proposal on that idea. You just got green lighted to really go with this thing. Okay, so you need to really think about this. This is really important for NSF and the NIH calling. Okay, getting in there. Because they have a little tiny bit different structure in their whole review process than USDA does. But they can be really helpful on things. With this. So this is really important. It's a good exercise for you. There's a bunch of USDA people are going to be here tomorrow. You can go talk to them right away if you got stuff going on. Get organized on a proposal early. Sort of think about what it's going to look like. Build a framework. Okay, make sure you have all the parts you need. So if you have odd stuff involved, you want to work on that early, like out-of-state colleagues, quotes on equipment, letters of support. Those things will kill you the last minute. Okay, start all that stuff early. Okay, that's why you have to define a title. And then I just give you a tip on letters of support. If you need a letter of support write a letter of support that you'd like to see in your proposal and send it to somebody to send it back to you. Okay? That makes sense? Do not rely on an outside, especially on the agency, to write you a decent letter of support direct up. Send them what you think the letter should say. They'll modify it and send it back. Yeah? Actually, NSF funds a lot of equipment. It's very competitive. It is the major equipment funding in the U.S. through NSF equipment grants, and they tend to be limited submissions. They're called. It means that your campus can only submit two to that program. So you have to sort of usually there's a pre-step on campus to pick the best two to send to NSF. Yes, they do. They fund. NIH does. NIH, I believe, only funds equipment for people who have NIH money. NSF will fund, I believe, anybody with, even if you don't have NSF money, you can potentially get equipment funded through NSF. It's not as high a probability. Actually, USDA doesn't fund a lot of equipment, so. So this is sort of the typical outline, you know, this varies, it's not all over the place. So you got introduction, you got methods, you got sort of the background summary. This is sort of the thing I use a little bit. And the 15 pages is varying. Agencies will change on you. Because it says 22 pages does not mean you need to fill 22 pages up. Okay? Reviewers like a shorter proposal. It's not necessary to fill up every line, every square centimeter on that page with text. Figures are nice to have. Graphics are nice to have. A little white space mixed in there is nice to have. Think of it from your point of view. Do you want to read a solid phone book looking thing? No, you don't. Neither do the reviewers. And they'll point that out in the review panel. They won't necessarily reject you for it, but they'll be critical of it. So it's kind of a, this is sort of real generalized. It can vary quite a bit with different things. When they ask for a timeline, this is something we recently, I was involved with on a review. They ask for a timeline, and it says that you have to provide a timeline of your research, and you don't. That can be a problem sometimes. So you need to get that in there in terms of the ask for it, make sure it's in there. So this is continued. You got references cited. Those don't count in your page limits. With exception of one agency I was involved with, it caught us by surprise late. We didn't look. It said references had to be included in the page limit. So we had 3 pages of references, 15 pages of text on a 15-page limit. It's kind of hard to sort of squeeze in 3 pages of text. Yeah, without taking something out. We took the references kind of out. But maybe the real short references where you have like a name and a date and some impossible to read abbreviation in the journal. So if they say biological scratches, you have to kind of watch what kind they want. There's a variety of those too. NSF's the best because they have a very defined format for their CVs. And I really like the NSF format. I wish they all used that. So you need to have like an NSF formatted CV, you need to have an NIH formatted CV, a USDA formatted CV, and your regular CV. I mean, that's the kind of thing you need to have sort of sitting around. Budget forms, start with your business office early on this stuff. Budget justification, do not underestimate the amount of time to write a decent budget justification and the importance of it in the proposal. Why do you need to make 16 trips to Hawaii to sample? I guarantee you, some reviewers, I swear, start at the budget justification and work back into the proposal. Because there's always some person on the panel that will say, well, you know, they didn't justify this pipetter very well. The $200 pipetter, what are you even talking about this? I mean, you sort of have to keep that in mind. Facilities and equipment, if you're asking for some kind of big piece of equipment in a proposal, you are basically red flagging yourself for a lot of discussion. So, keep that in mind if you put something in there. It's just not an automatic gimme. If you want a new GC, stick it in the supplies and equipment. You got to justify it. You got to really justify it. Because here's what comes up. They don't have one now. How can they know how to do this? Bad loop. It's generally an improvement of facilities you go after to improve throughput of samples. Okay. Communicate the importance of the topic, potential contributions of the research. Why are you doing this? It's important. Why are they, you know, all that kind of stuff. Get the expected outcomes out. Discussion of those. Relate them back to the objectives of the hypothesis. Do not make this proposal hard to read. These things should all tie together. Getting address the potential pitfalls. shortcomings of data, any kind of situation, your plan B, and then if you needed a good plan for dissemination of results. If they ask for a dissemination plan in the call, simply saying you're going to make a website to do that with will kill you. Okay? It's a great joke on a review panel. Oh, they're going to make a website. Again, you're making it easy on the reviewers if you make it too, you don't think about this stuff. Okay, so a well-written proposal will convince the reviewers the proposal's merit for funding. That's a draft. That's your goal. Completely. Clarity of what you're doing. Clear hypotheses and research questions. Clear objectives. Clear outcomes. Use your preliminary data. Use your publications. And if you have to do a research or an outreach plan, make sure it's clear. Who's doing what? How are you going to evaluate it? Okay? We actually put in, we just did a proposal where we are paying someone to evaluate us. Because it was in the proposal, was what was your evaluation plan going to look like? How are you going to check progress? And it was suggested to us by somebody in NSF that you pay to have that done. And there are people who will do that for you. So we have a contract line in there for an internal review of the project's progress. And it's actually easier to do. You just say you're going to hire a professional to take care of this part of the problem for you. They can't argue with it very much. So no stupid mistakes. Proofread. My favorite, my personal issue, is the word form and from. They're both spelled correctly. They look pretty funny in the wrong place. So you got to make sure you get the right words in the right places and make sure things are pretty much right. With the grants.gov and electronic submission, they're going to take away a lot of formatting creativity. Okay? Used to be you could be very creative on formatting. I mean, I'll just tell you a secret. You know, if you fixed a line width on a proposal, this is why I have no life. If you fixed a line width on a proposal that's 12 point, you get more stuff in there than if you have floating. Those kind of things, right? So they've taken all that away with this new electronic submission. It will reject your proposal if it's not formatted correctly. So you have to go back and try to figure out why it won't accept it, because it does a proofread thing to the PDF file it creates. So if it says 11-point font, certain 11-point certain font, whatever page width, et cetera, don't try to cheat it. It's going to catch it, kick it back out. And the reviewers don't like it when they're just. We had this proposal, this is 8 years, 10 years ago. We had this proposal that was, I swear, the margin was 1/4 inch. This is before USDA was stipulating margin width. And it was like line side to side, solid. You couldn't get any more words on the page. So if you're writing this stuff, formulate your scientific measurable objective. How are you gonna do this? And how are you gonna know you've done it right? Lay out your detailed research plan. Buff and polish the abstract. Here's why. You got a 22-member review panel. 3 people will read your proposal completely. Okay? The other bunch will read the abstract. If your abstract got some problems in it, somebody's going to help the 3 who read the whole proposal by pointing that out for you. Okay? Don't underestimate the importance of the abstract in this whole thing. Because a lot of people will look at it. And if you got something stupid in there, spelled wrong, some idea that's not clear, something going on there is not right, then you're going to get caught with that. Proofread. I got a friend who pays to have proofreading done on his. It's a lifestyle. So get organized early. Don't wait like me. Organize your hard drive. Get your backup location for your copies organized. A proposal never dies. Okay, it just maybe has a, it gets reborn occasionally in different forms, but you can keep all that, you can reuse parts of it. Materials and methods are pretty interchangeable in proposals. You need to fix them up for the specific situations. You need to get a referencing system for your literature going, stretch your CVs up, get that going. Each agency is different, but you're pretty close to the same. Start up your conflict of interest form, okay? That's important. All this stuff will save you, if you get this going early. Later on, when you're writing a proposal and it's due tomorrow and you're due to your office tomorrow and you're 2 in the morning, you have all this done, you're going to be a lot better off. So set up your current pending form. You guys know about those? Get those filled out, okay? Those are a big pain. And some agencies are now being very explicit about what you write on there. I actually saw one get kicked back, which I had never seen that before. Because someone had something weird written on the current and pending form. And current pendings are basically say what kind of grant money you have now or you are applying for presently. And it's a specific format that sort of lays out the grant proposal, who the agency is, how much money you have, and what your commitment of time is on there. Both in terms of what you got and what you're trying to get. So they sort of know where you are in the grant world. You have to fill it out. You have to do it correctly because it's actually a violation of federal law to apply for a proposal without including that information. Your business office can help you do it. Yeah?
If you are under contract with any agency and you're doing money, do you still have to do conflict of interest?
Yes. Yep. Conflict of interest is important. It's just that for two reasons. One, they want to see, they don't want to send your proposal to review, but somebody that's on your conflict list. That's why it's there. And two, what's the other reason? I can't remember. That's the primary reason. They don't want to double up on that in terms of sending a proposal to the wrong kind of person because it messes the whole process up if they do that. Kind of behind here. Budgeting, you really need to think about your budget early. Make your budget fit to project. You're not going to get rich on these things, but really sort of start it out and think about the whole thing. Your AY salary, your summer salaries, all that kind of stuff need to be included in that thing. And work with somebody on budgeting. You'd be surprised. Not the agencies don't care too much about the budget other than the total number and some other things that will happen later. But in terms of getting it right and saving yourself a lot of hassle, there's no reason for you to be doing the budget if you can get somebody else to do it for you, okay? Conservation of your time. I have a colleague who spent a huge amount of time writing a budget for a proposal, and I said, why don't you just turn it over to your business office and let them do it? Oh, we can do that?
Yes.
Let them do that, and they'll work with you on it. The process, okay? The agency's rules are the agency's rules. They have the money. It's their money. They make the rules. You follow the rules, okay? All this stuff is important. Font size, margins, all that stuff, it's kind of going to go away with this electronic submission. They're just going to reject you right away. It's going to kick right back. And it's going to say it's illegal. And now it's 3 in the afternoon, it's got to be turned in by 4, and you have a rejected proposal. That's going to be an exciting time in your life. Leaving out a required section will be fatal. If you have to have an outreach plan and you didn't put one in there, so sorry. The budget justification I sort of view as the truth in asking section. Why do you need this? Support it. That kind of thing. So, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but electronic submissions here to stay. Fastlane and grants.gov are the two major ones now. DOE, the Department of Education, uses some other weird system that no one knows anything about. If you never used this system before, you need to get registered in both of these, NSF and grants.gov, and you need to sort of go through their learning modules, make sure you know how to use it before you try to submit through it. There's certain things that have to happen. And you have to be registered on campus and then off campus as well. So do that early. Okay. Okay, reviews. Okay, there's a bunch of kinds of reviews. Most of them are done on panel. And there's two kinds of that. There's a scientist only, and then there's one where they have user groups in sciences. That's a USDA phenomenon. Not real common, but it does occur. Most of my experiences have been with panel review. And again, if you get asked to be on a panel to review something, you go, okay? There's somebody, an agency calls you up and says, hey, would you like to be on this review panel? You say, yes, when can I be there? Because it's an experience you don't want to miss, okay? So, this is all formalized in federal law, how this all works. Your proposal gets assigned to peer reviewers, okay? Your colleague, if necessary, it won't be anybody you know necessarily, but so it's possible to have like 3 to 6 external reviewers on your proposal. It's possible. It doesn't happen as much anymore. It happens with NSF that way. There tend to be, on the panel itself, there'll tend to be 3 panelists that look at your proposal, primary, secondary, and a third person. It's also sometimes called a reviewer, reader. And there'll be about 25 panelists in the room. That's pretty typical in a big program. So the panelists write their own review, but they'll see the ad hocs. So if they're using ad hocs, they're going to take all this information coming in. The real process of review is in the panel room itself. The review really occurs in the panel. The ad hocs, unless they really trash you, get used, but it's not as important as being in the room. So what happens in this process, this magical, mysterious world of review process, is the primary reviewer will stand up or sit down, usually it's just sitting there, and summarize your proposal. They want to convert yellow paper into white paper. That's the proposal. Okay. They'll summarize that. They're going to use some kind of asset procedure, yada, yada, yada. And then, after they summarize it, they will give their critique of it. Then they'll go to the secondary and the third person and do the same thing. They'll say, yeah, I think this is a good idea. Then they'll throw in anything the ad hocs have said at that point, enter the ad hocs, the outside reviews to look at. Then a proposal, then a discussion takes place. Okay? And it's a real discussion about your proposal will occur. And then there is a ranking that occurs at that point. Your proposal gets rated. Write it down, it's done. So what happens is you get this kind of thing, you get ranked, and arranged by the panel, or you get authorized. One of the two things will happen. So you're going to get ranked, which means that you're going to go from outstanding to do not fund. You want to be in the outstanding category. Okay, you want to be all the way over there on the left side of the board. So you don't want to be in that DNF category. That's not a pleasant letter to get. So your goal is to achieve this outstanding ranking, which puts you in an automatic, fundable category. You will get funded if there's money. Okay, that's what outstanding really translates into. Very good or subject to, if you get a very good rating, it tends to get subject to a rearrangement later on. You could be very high and very good one day, and be very low and very good the next day, and then this kind of thing happens. So this is a tote board arrangement. You've got an outstanding there, which is going to get money, and then you're going to be ranked within the very goods. In some place in the very good pile, they're going to make a cut. They're going to run out of money. Then you get on this little situation called the wrong side of very good. So the line is drawn, and everything to the right of that line is not going to get any money. And you can have a very good, high-quality proposal that doesn't get funded because they run out of money. So your goal is to be outstanding, or if you're not in outstanding, the very top of very good. Very rarely does a good proposal get funded. So it just makes these rankings make a little sense. If you're not going to get a ranking, this is what happens here. You get basically two piles, acceptable and unacceptable. The goal is to make the unacceptable pile bigger than the acceptable pile. So then they're going to rank. Then the agency tends to rank within the acceptable pile. So it's a different kind of arrangement. You can get multiple panels, which I don't like because you get different things going on in different rooms. So what they'll do is they'll go to two panels. They have a lot of proposals. They have excellent proposals out of both panels. They'll combine those together, and then they'll do some kind of ranking of those excellent proposals to get an arrangement. You're going to get rejected somewhere in your life, I guarantee it. You're going to get really mad about it, okay? And you may even throw something. Oh, that's just me. But the key here is these are the kind of things that people get rejected for. Little or no relevance to the agency's mission or program priorities. You should have known that before you submitted it, right? You read the priorities. You should point the priorities out in your proposal. How does your proposal meet their priorities? You should tell them in text. Say, my proposal, some wording that said how your proposal is going to help their priorities. Insufficient preliminary data. It's a beautiful rejection point. It gets used all the time. Okay? Good idea, but there's no data here to support this concept. Rejected. And then just a poorly written, at least tracks changes on. So page limits are exceeded, or unclear hypotheses or objectives, those are all. And then you get excess budget limits. That's usually not a rejection point anymore. Okay, on a resubmission, this is really critical, and this is really, it surprises people, but if you resubmit a proposal that's been rejected to the same agency, they know you've resubmitted it, even if you don't tell them that you're resubmitting. Okay? Because you have a little box that says check, that says resubmitted. And most people will check that. Well, some people will try to say, oh, I don't want to tell them I'm resubmitting this. But they catch it, and then they'll bring into the room, we'll come into the room last year's submission with the review comments on it. We'll mysteriously appear in the room. So the panel will get to see with last year's comment and this year's proposal, and then they'll write the following statement that says failed to address review comment from last year. That will kill you. So the way to get around this is, is take that to your advantage. You got rejected last year, fine, that's great. Those reviewers are the brilliant, most brilliant people in the world. They saw my flaws. I fixed them all, and here's how I did it. Do that in the first section. There's a section called response to review criteria comments. Use that section to your advantage. Okay? Just assume that you can just use that section to make your proposal better. That's actually extra pages if you look at it that way too. I've done that, it worked beautifully. I got rejected one year, we came back the next year, we took each of the comments, we put them in bold and said, this is what we did to fix the proposal because of this reviewer. This brilliant reviewer caught this problem in our head. The other thing is that the panels don't completely turn over, so there'll be maybe a quarter to half repeat people in the room from last year. So sometimes they have magical memory and they can bring it all back from the previous year, so it's pretty good. Then you have all this other stuff going on. Written poorly, basic flaws in logic, et cetera, that's all pretty standard stuff, lack of sense of understanding. That's a big one. So this is really important. If you're on the wrong side of high priority, and they say you had a high priority, which are good, very good, and you didn't get funded, you basically have a hot proposal you can resubmit and probably get funded, okay? So you need to submit that. You will resubmit that. If you don't, you're being really foolish. You have a very good rating or a really high rating, a high priority or a very good, you have a proposal that can get funded. You need to fix whatever they said was wrong if it's in the back. Okay, probably pretty trivial. I don't even get mad about it. I say, oh, fine. You know, just turn it around, send it back in the back. You get into other things, good or poor, you need to sort of start thinking about some major reconstruction. Okay. And whatever you do, do not ridicule the reviewers in this resubmission. These are the dumbest people I've ever dealt with in my life. This isn't going to go good for you. I've seen it, but it's not going to go good for you. Fix your flaws. That's the key out of that slide. Listen to the panel. Okay, those are your scientific peers. They have read your proposal. They have ruled on your proposal. Now you have to go back and fix whatever you did with it. And do not call, I was asked to put this in here by a program manager. Do not call the program manager and complain. They get them all the time. They can't do a thing about it. And all they can do is tell the panel the next time that you called. So I'm going to give you this other thing here. Okay, that's all my proposal stuff. I got a couple little things here. This is something I've recently come across, and I think it's really important, especially if you're starting out. We're starting to move towards this thing called an H-index for evaluation of scientific impact. You guys familiar with this H-index thing? Okay. I was in a big discussion with some folks about it, and this whole notion of how you format your name on these computer searches is really critical for your publications. So if you have a middle initial, start using it. Okay? Because it makes this whole searching thing they do for an H-index value work better. So if you have a name, and you're thinking about changing it for some whatever reason, maybe you're hiding out somewhere or something, don't. If you have publication under the first name, okay, you're going to lose that H index value. And it makes it much more complex. I just put this in here because I've just been dealing with this a lot recently because we've been doing promotion stuff. And this H index, if you don't know about the H index, you should look it up. So I'm just put H index into Google and you'll get a whole bunch of stuff on it. But it's the way that people are talking about evaluating the scientific of a faculty member. You have an H-index value. They range from zero to some big, huge number. You don't want to be zero, which means you have no impact at all. I think we should have created negative. Sucks away value. So the H-index, you can do it in Google Scholar also. There's a way to do it there too. But the H-index value is based on your name. You've got to find your name in the literature and find it correctly. So pick a name format you want to use and use it all your papers from now on. I don't care what it is. Just decide what you want to do. The more detail you can put in there, the better off you are. So your middle initial is a good thing to add for me it is, because there's another guy, it's Richard Turco, that is this, if I use R. Turco, I get this gigantic H-index number, which is great, except it's all his papers. It's Rich, he's an atmospheric chemist in California. So this is collaborators. You guys are going to get pulled every which way to be collaborators, especially nice young professors coming in. Oh, you guys are all full of great ideas. think about how much collaboration you want to do. I, for the first part of my career, had one guy I worked with all the time. It was great. It's two of us that did a lot of stuff together. That was my collaborator. So I didn't have 50 people I worked with. I had two, three people I worked with. It was great. And then that's something you need to really sort of set up and decide the number you want to work with and go with. And I really recommend, regardless of what people say to you, you do not try and lead a large project before you have your own project program started, okay? It doesn't go well for you long term. If it gets funded, okay, maybe it's great, but then you have to manage it. And managing a project is not a particularly promotable situation. It's great that you can do it, but it doesn't have a lot of tenure capacity. Collaborators are sort of a fact of life. I've gone both ways. I have a couple of big projects and I got a couple of 2PI projects. I prefer the 2PI projects in a lot of ways. But you get sort of stuck with some of these big agencies. So if you get involved in one of these, make sure you have a role that's well defined, that you can get a grad student or a postdoc out of a big project, and that you can make sure you keep your value in your program as well as the bigger project value. This is, I got two things I want to show you and get to go. Here are my four types of collaborative projects. Collaboration by staple. Has been involved with one of those. Since they'll say, send us your CV and we're going to put you in this project. Put a staple in it. So you can be driven by collaboration. You really want to be a collaborator. You get in these situations. This is what I've been involved with a lot, and I don't like it, is that you're forced into these quick linkages, right? We get this big RFP coming out on whatever, biofuels. That's a big, huge RFP area. And we need all these people to respond, we need all these areas, and they don't really want to know what you do, they just want you on the proposal. And so it's often done with strangers, and it's got limited trust factor involved. It's not an unusual situation, you just need to watch how much of that you get involved with. I really don't like this top-down kind of stuff. I like true multidisciplinary efforts where you develop a proposal with a group of individuals, you really work on that concept piece before this whole thing gets done. So you have a long-term interaction that leads to a proposal. That's a much better place to be than one of these rapid response kind of things, which seem to be really popular. Here's why. Single versus multi-investigator projects. So one single, you and somebody else usually get one leader, one agenda, one business office, one department head, one scientific approach, one set of personal objectives of obligations. Over here on the multi-investigator side, you got shared vision, which means no one really knows what they're doing. It's all going in 12 different ways. You have multiple agendas, multiple offices, multiple department head, multiple approaches, and multiple languages in terms of how you do things, and then multiple obligations, personal level. So this is what I'm going to conclude with here. This is my asset factor index for scientific work. On the bottom axis, you've got, on this axis here, the log value, okay? It's a log value. It's a log asset factor. Now, this is actually how I count this. This is real line. And down here, people on the proposal, and the different colored lines are different number of objectives in the proposal. Okay, this is the asset factor. The log value, it goes from something reasonable in the zero range, 0 to 1, to 50. 50 orders of magnitude of hassle. And you guys think I'm just kidding on you. This is true. You get six people on a five objective proposal, and you've got the most hassle-laden 2 weeks of your life ever going there. So, I vetted this with a couple people. I showed this to a couple of my colleagues, and they said, I think you need to change that equation because it multiplies it even more. I said, no. So it's PI times objectives times all these things happen, and this is really the kind of thing you end up with in your life. You got to think about it in a big multidisciplinary project. How much of this do you want right now? You want some of that, okay? You want a little bit, but you don't want this to be the only thing you do. So think about the big projects; they're important, but you're going to really have to develop your own program. You got to get your own program going first. And I had a vice provost say that. True multidisciplinary projects are really only possible when you have really strong disciplinary expertise to bring to the project. So you really got to get your disciplinary expertise going and strengthened and in place. Then you can be a true collaborator on a multidisciplinary project at that point. Let me try to minimize some of this, but this is about it. Oh yeah, ruby slippers. Read the RFP, talk to the program manager, key steps. Allow time for both writing and completing the paperwork and getting approvals, okay? Never insult last year's panel or program manager. Never insult the program manager, okay? They are very subtle in their retaliatory methods. They'll wait. You'll never know it came and hit you. First, you don't succeed, try and try again. Maybe it's a different agency this time, but you really need to think about this as a long-term proposal. Is sort of, it's often a long-term process, maybe a couple of years to get them done. So first time in, okay, you got rejected, take the comments, fix the proposal, resubmit it. So, with, oh yeah, questions now. Those are often forced on you. That may be the wrong way to answer that, but I have used that one time, and the logic model's arrangement is, I didn't work it out very successfully, I guess. So yes, it's being talked about, but I don't see it being used a lot.